Thank you for joining me for today's Beast Watch News Update. News from the Internet's most comprehensive Bible prophecy news website, BeastWatchNews.com. I'm Kimberly Rogers Brown. Is Iran Daniel's end time king of the north? Let's examine the role of Iran in the end of days. Yahweh is revealing increasingly more information the closer we get to the final war over Jerusalem, which of course is Armageddon. The only way to understand that war and put together how the puzzle pieces fit together is to look at how the world's alliances and politics are shaping up to see if these elements fit any of the Bible's prophecies. And indeed, they do. Just so you know, Iran is your enemy. Iran embodies the spirit of Amalek in the end of days. Amalek embodies the utter hatred and desire to murder and annihilate Jacob and all of his descendants on behalf of Esau. Amalek picked up Esau's hatred of Jacob, carried it with him from the beginning, showed up to try to annihilate the Israelites when they came out of Egypt at Passover, showed up again when the Babylonians took the three tribes, Judah, Levi, and Benjamin, into captivity under the guise of Haman, and they will show up again in the end of days at the Great Tribulation as the Iranians and Russians. Iran, which is the ancient Persians, and Russians, who are also ancient Persians, have an ongoing hatred for the West, which is where Jacob migrated to, trying to get away from Esau and his descendants, the Edomites. Iran is prophesied to attack Israel, while Russia and its allies, China and North Korea, and possibly the Iranians with them, will attack the West, beginning with America, but also America's allies, Europe, Australia, New Zealand, Japan, Guam, Philippines, etc. When I say Iran embodies Amalek, I don't mean that every Iranian is a descendant of Esau's grandson, Amalek. There are many Hebrews from ancient Israelite stock trapped still in that area from the time of the ancient Babylonian captivity. They believe themselves to be Iranians, and many of them have picked up the hatred against their own kindred people of Israel, because that's how hatred works. This is why the Bible talks about those who are brethren fighting their own brethren. But still, these people are not Amalek. Yahweh said that Esau, and particularly Amalek, is bound for destruction. We are to fight Amalek in every generation to destroy Amalek. But the Lord said his own people he will save. This is why you and I cannot go around declaring who will be and who will not be in the kingdom. Some of Yahweh's people, our own brethren, are trapped inside Islam and inside the Catholic and Protestant churches, while at the same time, Islam and Christianity also holds many Edomites too. We can know the spirit of Esau and Amalek by what they say and do about and to the Jews and Israel. Anti-Semitism is a big clue on who is and who is not Israel. Jerusalem is another issue that tells us a lot about who people really are. Those whose heart is like Yahweh's heart, which is forever in Jerusalem, will have a burning desire to be there. They will want Yahweh's heart to feel them in Jerusalem for the feasts, and his eyes to see them praying at the foot of the retaining wall, also known as the Western Wall. These are truly Yahweh's inheritance, his people. But Let's go back to Iran. Islam is not your enemy. Esau is, Amalek is, and just as happened during the first Exodus when Amalek led the way to attempt to annihilate Jacob in the wilderness, Amalek will do once again the same thing at the second Exodus. Thus, we can expect Iran, the home of Haman, the descendant of Amalek, to lead the charge against Israel as the king of the north. Iran today is the remnant nation of the ancient Persian Empire that included all of what today is Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Turkey, and even part of Egypt. The great Persian king Cyrus established Persian control over the ancient Near East during his reign, and it included part of Egypt and also parts of India. A prophecy in that ancient Persian Empire's eschatology says that it will become a world superpower in the end of days. It is this prophecy, along with the prophecy of the Mahdi, which is the foundation for the end-time King of the North's conquest of the Middle East. The prophecy about the King of the North in the end of days is that he will occupy all of Egypt, indicating that the ancient Persian Empire that rises in the end of days will have an even larger territory than it had before. The book of Daniel tells us this in chapter 11, verses 41 to 43, which says, "He shall enter into the glorious land," that's Israel, "and many countries will be overthrown. But these shall escape out of his hand, Edom and Moab and the chief of the children of Ammon. He shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. But he shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver and over all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and Ethiopians shall be at his steps." The greater part of Egypt and none of Libya and Ethiopia were part of ancient Persia. Egypt, Libya, and Ethiopia will become part of the arisen Persian Empire superpower during the war by the King of the North. Iran is the head of a new coalition that looks like the mainland area of ancient Persia, with just a couple of exceptions that I'll explain as we go along. I want to talk about this coalition, because according to Wikipedia, the Russia-Syria-Iran-Iraq coalition, also referred to as the 4+1, in which the plus one refers to Hezbollah of Lebanon, is a joint intelligence-sharing cooperation between opponents of the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, that's ISIL, with operation rooms in Syria's Damascus and Iraq's Green Zone in Baghdad. It was formed as a consequence of an agreement reached at the end of September 2015 between Russia, Iran, Iraq, and Syria to help and cooperate in collecting information about the terrorist Daesh group, ISIL, also known as ISIS, with a view to combating the advances of the group, according to the statement issued by the Iraqi Joint Operations Command. The statement also cites the increasing concern from Russia about thousands of Russian terrorists committing criminal acts within ISIS. Now, we're going to find out who the Russians are in a minute, but for now, we're going to talk about one element of this, which has to do with Turkey. The modern nation of Turkey is missing from Iran's ancient Persian map so far. It was geographically part of the ancient Persian Empire and is now being courted by Iran and Russia. It may be that Turkey will join the end-time Persian coalition headed by Iran and backed by Russia. But now we're going to find out who the Russians are, really. The Russian people are ancient Medes and Persians. Here's a statement from the Encyclopedia Britannica, 11th edition. The Caucasus region was usually incorporated into the Iranian world. The Iranian world here has to be interpreted as ancient Persia. Stick with me and you'll find out why. Large parts of Russia were ruled by empires based in modern-day Iran for a time span encompassing many centuries, from the early 16th century up to and including the early 19th century. Transcaucasia and a part of the North Caucasus, namely Dagestan, were ruled by the successive Safavid, Afsharid, and Qajar dynasties of Iran, and they made up part of the latter's concept for centuries. In the course of the 19th century, by the Treaty of Golestan of 1813 and the Treaty of Turkmenchay of 1828, Iran ceded that region to Russia. Ever since, the Dagestan region still makes up part of Russia. People from the former and contemporary boundaries of Iran have a long history in the territory of what is today modern-day Russia, and this stretches back thousands of years. Throughout history, the Iranians have a long history within what is modern-day Russia, stretching back millennia, with their historical core in southern Dagestan and the pivotal Iranian town of Derbent. The territory remained intermittently in Iranian hands, encompassed for many centuries until 1813. This resulted in a steady flow and settling of people from mainland Iran. There are two historically Iranian communities in Russia, the Tats, who are among the native inhabitants of the North Caucasus, and the Mountain Jews, who descend from Persian Jews from Iran. The migration from the area of the ancient Persian Empire, particularly from its remnant territory, which is Iran today, has continued up to the present. As the Encyclopedia Iranica states, the number of Persians in the Russian Empire or its territories increased steadily in the second half of the 19th century following the forced ceding of the Caucasus of Qajar, Iran, to Russia several decades earlier by the Treaty of Golestan of 1813 and the Treaty of Turkmenchay of 1828. These migrants consisted primarily from Persia's northern provinces, that's Azerbaijan, who traveled to the Caucasus and to some extent to Central Asia in search of employment. Although the bulk of migrants were involved in some form of short-term or circular migration, many stayed in Russia for longer periods or even settled there. Migration from Iran to Russia increased greatly in the 1800s, and I believe this was a move of Yahweh to set up the events at the end of days and to obscure Russia's origins so that not everyone would catch on to what Yahweh was doing. He wants to take the world by surprise using the King of the North. The first traces of migration were recorded as early as 1855. The British consul in Tabriz reported more than 3,000 passes issued by the Russian consulate in 2 months alone. However, the process gathered pace after the 1880s, and by the turn of the century, it had achieved a scale and consistency that was sufficient to win the attention of many scholars, travelers, and commentators of that time. According to the returns from the first national census of Russia in 1897 and cited by the Encyclopedia Iranica, some 74,000 Persian subjects were enumerated in the various parts of the empire as of 28 January 1897. The largest single grouping was in the Caucasus region, which accounted for 82% of the total. As the census states, within the region there were four major towns that accounted for as many as 53,000, or about 72% of all Persians in the entire empire. Next to Caucasus in numbers of Persian residents was Central Asia, where numbers surpassed 10,000. According to the same 1897 census source, Persian speakers, as distinct from Persian subjects, numbered only about 32,000, suggesting the predominance of Azeri-speaking Azerbaijans among those migrants. There are many travelers' accounts and political memoirs that attest to the importance of the numbers involved, but they are often considered to be contradictory or incomparable. Ethner notes that the further useful information is, however, available from data on passports and visas issued at the Russian consulates in Tabriz, Mashhad, Rasht, and Astarabad. The number of Persian travelers to Russia averaged about 13,000 per year for the period of 1876 to 1890, and rising to over 67,000 at the turn of the century. By 1913, over a quarter of a million Persians were reported to have entered Russia. However, this excludes illegal migration, which by many accounts was also quite substantial. And equally large numbers of Persians were reported to have left Russia each year. Be that as it may, as Hakimian further states in this report, it has been estimated that net immigration to Russian territories amounted to about 25,000 each year on average between 1900 and 1913. The total number of Persians in Russia before World War I is thus likely to have been about 500,000. According to other accounts, too, the politicalization of Persian workers in Russia was extensive during a period beset by revolutionary turmoil in both countries. In the 1906 strike in the copper mines and plants of Alaverdi in Armenia, about 2,500 Persian Azerbaijanis were believed to constitute the core of strikers. This politicization was also reflected in the forcible extraditions of 1905, which was referred to in another article. Persians also took part in political activities between World War I and the October Revolution. In 1914, as Chakeri states, workers residing in Baku took part in street demonstrations against the outbreak of war. Soon after the October Revolution, a group of Persian workers in Baku founded the party Adalat, which was to become the Communist Party of Persia in 1920. In 1935, the Persian government requested the countries which it had diplomatic relations with to change its name from Persia to Iran. It should be clear by now that Russians and Iranians are the same people. The Russians are the secular Red Edomite communists, while the Iranians are the religious Islamic Edomites. Edomites are the descendants of Jacob's twin brother Esau. The Great Tribulation is the culmination of the conflict between Jacob and Esau. Both Russia and Iran are biblically represented by a bear. The bear in the book of Daniel represents the Persian Empire. As a people group, the Persian Empire is Russia and Iran together. The Russian and Iranian populations are the Persians, the ancient Persians, hiding under two different names. The book of 2 Kings chapter 2 talks about these two bears. The king of the north in Daniel 11 attacks Israel, part of Jordan, Egypt, Libya, and Ethiopia in order to invade the king of the south, which today is Saudi Arabia. The book of Revelation says there is an end-time king that rides on a white horse going out, conquering and to conquer. We know he is a king because he already is wearing a crown. Revelation 6:2, "And I saw, and behold, a white horse, and he that sat on him had a bow, and a crown was given to him, and he went forth conquering and to conquer." The king riding on the white horse is the crowned Shiite Iranian Persian king, named as such in Daniel 11, who is going out to settle the issue between themselves and the Sunnis. So why would Gog and the king of the north attack Israel at nearly the same time? It is because Israel has something both of them want, except that they both want different things. Gog wants control of Israel's oil and gas. The U.S. and its allies are losing the war for control of Syria's distribution pipeline. They will fight to the last to maintain control of Israel's oil and gas, to keep it out of Russian and Iranian control. Even the least educated person on earth should know by now that the entity who controls all of the Middle East's oil and gas controls the rest of the world. And when the Iranian coalition attacks Saudi Arabia, they will control Saudi Arabia's oil and gas as well. The U.S. has recently been escalating the war in Syria because its allies, the Free Syrian Army and other groups that are backed by the U.S., are losing the war. According to AllMonitor.com, the U.S. escalation is solidifying the Russian-Iranian 4-plus-1 coalition. It says, while the United States is becoming increasingly assertive in keeping the Syrian army and its allied forces away from the Iraqi border, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's main allies, namely Iran and Russia, have started to redefine their strategies to preserve their vital interests in the war-torn country. The United States' shooting down of a Syrian fighter jet on June 18 was regarded as an indicator of elevated U.S. military activism in Syria in support of its partners. Reacting to the shooting down of the Syrian aircraft, Russia drew its own red line, with the Defense Ministry declaring that any airborne objects found west of the Euphrates River would be considered targets. However, this is not the whole picture, as eastern Syria has become the focal point for Iran, too. The very fact that Iran on June 18 chose Deir ez-Zor as the target of its first missile strike against ISIS positions signaled the significance of the region in Iran's strategic calculations. mindful of these developments, the question now is why the situation in eastern Syria has suddenly become so fragile and what consequences this could have for the future of Syria. It appears that the United States and its allies were hopeful that Aleppo would be the peak of Assad's military achievements, after which he would enter talks with the rebels to jointly determine the status quo of other parts of the country. In the past month, the Syrian army has not only advanced toward the areas held by U.S.-backed rebels at the border with Jordan and Iraq, and I might add Israel, but have also started to march toward Raqqa from the west. This potentially puts in danger the fate of the U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces, the SDF, after the recapture of Raqqa from ISIS. Therefore, the United States has seemingly come to the conclusion that there won't be a military solution in line with its interests in Syria, as the rebels are losing more ground, and that it's not even possible to freeze the situation as it was right after the Syrian government's recapture of East Aleppo. In these circumstances, the only possible and logical option for the United States and its allies is to reinforce their current positions inside Syria and to concentrate on the areas that have the most potential to successfully be retaken by American-backed forces. In this vein, the United States is more vigorously trying to keep pro-Assad and pro-Iran forces away from Al-Tanf and is also eager to accelerate SDF operations in Raqqa. Thus, the United States is now concentrating on its current core interests in Syria, containing Iran's influence, preserving a minimum level of balance of power between different forces, and at the top of the list, safeguarding Israel's security by preventing Syrian army advances further southward. So recently, I have gotten this understanding. I now see what is happening based on the events that are taking place in the Middle East, in Syria. And even this AlMonitor.com, which is an Arab news outlet, believes that the United States is trying to safeguard Israel's security. That is what Ezekiel 38 says. Guard them. Who's them? Israel. This is how Yahweh brings Gog, the descendant of Reuben, back to Israel from where he should never have left in order to punish him for doing so. Now, back to the article. As such, the above-mentioned developments mean that the United States has already started to delineate its zones of influence inside Syria. In turn, Assad's allies, namely Iran and Russia, have reacted by concentrating more on their own core interests. For Iran, the most important aim is to preserve its access to Lebanon through Syria, which is why it has shifted its concentration to eastern Syria. Iran has already taken the first steps in this regard as the Popular Mobilization Units, a pro-Iranian Iraqi force, reached Iraq's border with Syria on May 30th, and as Syrian forces seized control of an eastern area bordering Iraq on June 9th. However, Russia, as another main ally of the Syrian government, presents a rather different story. Moscow's most vital interest in Syria, guaranteeing access to the Mediterranean Sea by safeguarding its military bases in western Syria, is already preserved. Nonetheless, as a world power, the broader situation in Syria is also important for the Russians in terms of preserving their international prestige. This means not abandoning an ally right after a geopolitical achievement. Russia and Iran are expected to increase their cooperation with Assad to help him retake the eastern parts of the country, thereby preventing a drastic shift in the balance of power in favor of the United States. Syria has effectively been divided into different zones of influence between the two main power constellations involved in the country. The outcome of this is clear. The process of reaching a political solution will become more complicated, at least when it comes to a solution that could preserve Syria's territorial integrity. At the same time, there is also a risk of direct clashes between the United States and its forces on the one side and Iran and Russia on the other. That, my friends, is Persia, Ethiopia, and Libya. Okay, Persia is Iran. Iran is the king of the north, and that king of the north is the coalition, the 4+1 coalition. Iran's reason for attacking Israel will be only partly for control of the oil and gas in Israel that it will perceive the United States has control of. But Iran has another agenda, which Gog does not have, which is to obtain the Islamic Caliphate and conquer the Sunni Muslims. Iran's coalition will attack one time to take care of two situations. First, to get control of all the gas and oil in the Middle East, and two, to conquer Saudi Arabia. Iran won't wait long after Gog occupies Israel before it attacks. And there is more. These two bears, Russia and Iran, appear prophetically in the account of Elijah and Elisha in 2 Kings chapter 2. Reading from the Amplified Version, starting at 2 Kings 2, verse 23, says, "Then Elisha went up from Jericho to Beit El." So Elisha is going back to Beit El after Elijah was taken away to the city of one of Jeroboam's golden calves, where he would continue Elijah's ministry of calling the house of Israel to repentance and to return to Jerusalem. And in verse 24, it says, "On the way, young boys came out of the city and mocked him." Young boys, these are young nations. The United States and the Western nations are young nations. "They came out of the city and mocked him and said to him, 'Go up, you bald head, go up, you bald head.' When he turned around and looked at them, he cursed them in the name of the Lord. Then two female bears came out of the woods and tore to pieces 42 of the boys." The 42 boys represent the 42 months of the Great Tribulation. This is a clue for us. The two bears that come out of the woods are Russia and Iran in the end of days. The fact that they are female bears is significant because mother bears who are watching over their offspring, you know, the war in Syria and all those nations around Iran in that area of the Middle East, that offspring are particularly ferocious. The bears spring on the boys suddenly from their wooded and camouflaged hiding place, taking the boys by surprise. This is in keeping with the prophecy about the destruction of end-time Babylon. In effect, There are two bears on the earth today, and they have formed a dangerous coalition that will strike the Sunni Arab nations, Israel, Jordan, Egypt, Libya, and Ethiopia. This is why Libya and Ethiopia will be with Persia, Iran, as the Bible states in Ezekiel 38:5. These two nations will have been captured by Iran very quickly after Gog goes to occupy Israel. My friends, Israel will become a battleground between Gog and the King of the North as they struggle for control of Israel and its natural resources. But what will be the end of Iran? Jeremiah 49, 38, and 39 has something to say about it. I will set my throne in Elam and will destroy from there the king and the princes, says the Lord. But it shall come to pass in the latter days that I will bring again the captivity of Elam, says the Lord. Who is Elam? Elam is an ancient biblical name for the Iranian people of today. The bottom line is that we face two reawakened empires, two bears that have joined forces. The Iranian bear will conquer the Middle East and subjugate Sunni Islam under a new caliphate. The Russian bear will go after the United States, Europe, and the other westernized nation. But Russia and Iran will assist each other in these wars. The red horse will ride immediately after the white horse. Russia represents secular Edomites, while Iran represents religious Edomites. The two Edomites are descendants of Jacob's twin brother Esau, who wants his birthright and blessing back. Together, these two bears will try to conquer the earth. They almost get away with it, but Yahweh says he will bring again their captivity and put a stop to their attempted coup against Jacob. So now you know what to watch for. What or who will set the stage for this Iranian invasion the Bible calls the King of the North war? President Donald Trump has endangered both Jordan and Israel in his latest ceasefire deal with Russia's President Vladimir Putin. Trump acted on his own without consulting his Pentagon staff in this matter, just as he did on the Al-Sharat airfield on April 6, 2017. After that attack, the Pentagon stated they had no idea Trump planned the attack. The Atlantic.com website reported this week that the Pentagon had been once again left out of the loop regarding Trump's plan to hand over Daraa and Quneitra. With this latest deal, Trump has inadvertently opened the way for the King of the North to attack Israel and Jordan in exactly the way that the Bible predicts. Russian troops entered southern Syria for the first time on Wednesday, July 13, when they occupied the town of Daraa to start enforcing the partial ceasefire agreed to by Trump and Putin in Hamburg on July 7th. Daraa is a small city about 12 kilometers from the Jordan border with a very big military importance. One of the highways running through Daraa is the ancient biblical King's Highway. This particular section of the King's Highway leads directly from Daraa to the Jordan border. While Scripture does not specify how the King of the North will attack Jordan, I believe it is prophetically significant that the much-disputed King's Highway is once again back in play, albeit a more northern section than was fought over before. The King's Highway was a strategic route from before the exodus of the Israelites. It is referred to as Derech HaMelech in the books of Numbers and Deuteronomy, where it is related that the Israelites needed to use the road that in part of its southern section passes through Edomite territory in what is now southern Jordan. The Edomite king refused them passage. The same request was made to King Sihon in Deuteronomy chapter 2. He refused, and the Israelites went to battle against him and won, opening the territory for occupation by the tribes of Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh. The king's highway still exists and is used today. In ancient times, it ran from Damascus to the Gulf of Aqaba, where it forked into a route that crossed the Sinai into Egypt and a route that ran along the eastern coast of the Red Sea into what is now Saudi Arabia. It is likely that this section of the highway was used by the Israelites on their way to Mount Sinai. Many of the wars fought by the Israelites, including the final war of the Jews against the Edomites, were probably fought, at least in part, over control of the highway. This highway was a crucial part of the Silk Road trade between the Chinese and Nabataeans, the descendants of Ishmael's son Nebaoth, who built Petra. Today, the King's Highway is still a strategic and prophetically significant road that runs through Syria and into Jordan through the town of Daraa. Thus, Daraa is a prophetically strategic town in southern Syria that President Donald Trump just handed over to Russia's Vladimir Putin. From this article on Forward.com, I quote, "This development is a result of the United States allowing its proxy, the Free Syrian Army, to repeatedly violate ceasefire agreements. Trump's and Putin's agreement appears, on the face of it, to be a solution to end the Syrian war and prevent stray shells and bullets from straying into Israel's Golan Heights. But there is far more to this ceasefire than a mere cessation of hostilities next door. By augmenting Russia's capacity to affect Israel's strategic interests, it could have far-reaching consequences. The first king of the north was ancient Persia. The next two are Greek. Daniel 11 up to verse 39 details the wars between the Greek generals to gain control of all the territory left to them by Alexander the Great. Daniel 11 verses 40 to 45 posits a final battle with no known historical sequence corresponding to that which is laid out in the previous verses. Many interpreters of Daniel consider this section to contain a reference to a much more distant future from Daniel's time, likely a future that has now arrived. Whereas Daniel 11 begins with the current king being of Persian origin, the next two kings of the north being Greek, we now must decide if the fourth king of the north will be Persian or Greek. It is unlikely that God will break the pattern of using either a Persian or Greek empire to raid Israel in the end of days. At the moment, Greece is not even a player in this scenario. The most that can be said about Greece becoming the end-time king of the north is that Greece would have to rise from the ashes to become a world superpower again. The likelihood of that happening is remote to almost impossible. Trump is continuing in Obama's New World Order steps. More from Forward.com, quote, "The Trump administration is following the Obama pattern of reducing involvement in Middle East military conflict to a greater extent than it may like to admit. This, too, is significant for Israel. While President Trump can be depended on to side with Israel against Iran, it is Moscow that Israel will have to address if, under the new ceasefire arrangements, Iran or Iranian proxy forces in Syria approach the border with Israel. Russia and Iran are allies in Syria. Russia and Israel most decidedly are not allies. However much Putin is reputed to admire Israel's security and technological skills, the Syria agreement reportedly prohibits entry of non-Syrians to the ceasefire zone, and it brings Jordan and Israel more closely than ever into strategic coordination regarding Syria. That means a relatively united front against violations. And violations there will be. After all, every ceasefire achieved in Syria over the past 6 years has collapsed. This one, too, is likely to be short-lived. Not only are resurgent forces loyal to Assad spoiling to reassert their sovereignty in the country's southwest, there are also around 50 diverse and conflicted militias there, some more militant and more Islamist than others. Unquote. Russian troops entered Kenitra this week. This from Debka.com. Russian army units are preparing to move into the town of Kenitra in the coming days to take up positions opposite the Syrian-Israeli Golan border. Their function is to police the second zone of southwestern Syria designated for ceasefire by President Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin when they met in Hamburg on July 7th. Kenitra is just 5 kilometers from Israel's border and the line of IDF positions defending it. Israel has notified Washington and Moscow that it is flatly opposed to the presence of a Russian unit on its border. However, the U.S. and Russian officers coordinating the ceasefire's implementation agreed to recommend going forward with the Russian deployment. The White House and the Kremlin gave the officers' recommendation the green light, virtually imposing it on Israel against its will. Their argument is that the first ceasefire zone that was established last week in the Daraa front on the Jordanian border will quickly break down if it is not shored up by a second zone at Kenitra. But the two zones differ in major respects, according to military and intelligence sources. The understandings drawn up for Daraa between the U.S., Russia, and Jordan included a clause explicitly providing for the withdrawal of Iranian and pro-Iranian forces, including Hezbollah, to a point 40 kilometers west or north of the demilitarized town. This clause never stood up for one moment. As Debka file first disclosed on July 16, even after Russian and Chechen troops moved into Daraa on Sunday, Syrian and Iranian forces did move out, but an elite Hezbollah unit remained. The U.S., Russia, and Jordan decided collectively to let this breach of the ceasefire deal go without response, and they tried to keep it dark. While acting to procure Jordan's acceptance for the new format, the two powers refrained from turning to Jerusalem. They knew they would be greeted with a flat rejection because of an earlier lapse. The clause providing for the 40-kilometer withdrawal of Iranian and pro-Iranian troops from Daraa was left out of the deal for Kenitra, heedless of urgent Israeli demands for its inclusion. The absence of any Trump-Putin commitment on this score leaves Israel fully exposed to the presence of Iranian and Hezbollah forces within mortar range of its Golan border in an area supervised by their not ally, the Russian military. It was this danger that galvanized Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu into broadcasting Israel's total opposition to the Trump-Putin ceasefire for southwestern Syria during his visit to Paris on Monday, July 17, after his talks with President Emmanuel Macron. In an apparent bid to calm Israel's concerns, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov made an unusual statement for a Russian diplomat. He said, "I can guarantee that we have done everything and the U.S. side has done everything to ensure that Israel's security interests within the framework are fully taken into account." Careful perusal of this comment revealed to Debka File's sources that it was made in the context of a previous ceasefire accord that the Russians had made for Turkey and Iran co-sponsors. Instead of reassurance, his comment was taken in Israel as a bid to ascertain that the arrival of Russian troops in Kunitra over Israel's strenuous objections would go smoothly. Does that sound like Russia has no evil intent toward Israel? Of course Russia intends to help Iran in the coming invasion, whether directly or indirectly. I hope this has helped you to identify the King of the North. Keep watching and listening to the Jerusalem Report every week. That's it for this Beast Watch News update. This is Kimberly Rogers Brown signing off. Click over to BeastWatchNews.com for full comprehensive coverage of all the headlines fulfilling end of days Bible prophecy.